Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Listen.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks, as always, for making your way here, checking out the episode in the series. I do hope you hit the subscribe button. I put out three new interviews every single week. It's a new one every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists, discover some new ones, and know what's happening in the music world. And, of course, you can subscribe at all the usual spots like iTunes and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, Podchaser, NPR, YouTube for the video versions, or, again, anywhere you get your podcasts from. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, I get to talk to one of my biggest heroes of all time, talking about REM, Michael Stipe and Mike Mills. We're going to be remembering the 1996 album, New Adventures in Hi-Fi, for its 25th anniversary. The box set just arrived a few weeks ago. The rock legends are going to be talking about writing the bulk of the record while touring the Monster album, the idea of spontaneity within the songs, and Stipe using religion as a writing tool. We also hear what it was like for the lead singer to meet his idol, Patti Smith, for the first time, as well as hearing Eddie Vedder and Jason Isbell's recent REM covers, and new music on the way from both individuals. It's the 25th anniversary of New Adventures in Hi-Fi, and it's Kyle Meredith with REM.
Hello, Kyle.
Hey there. Hi there. How's it going?
It's great. Great to see you both on here. We're jumping, as you do these days when you're together in the time machine, heading back to 1996, talk about a little record over my shoulder called New Adventures in Hi-Fi, which has got the big deluxe edition and just one of the greatest albums of all time. I know, as the story goes, a lot of these songs were recorded on the Monster Tour. It ended up being a road record that wasn't typically a road record, but I'm going to start with a very heady question, I guess is where I'm going here. The road as a backdrop, as a character. We're told about albums that are kind of snapshots of artists, but this one really does, even now, more so now, feel like a snapshot of America, of life at the time. I'll sort of toss this one up to whoever wants it. As you look back on it, what is the world that you captured?
I was never an autobiographic writer, and this record is the same. I was kind of really in the very, very, very beginning, because I just wrote what I knew. And then I realized that I didn't want to do that anymore. This is not at all a record about a band on the road or my experience being in a band on the road. Although we did work up, the guys worked up a lot of the arrangements and a lot of the songs while we were on the Monster Tour and played them at sound checks and in the dressing rooms, and I was in the next dressing room over listening. The really great thing for me is that I was able to, the melodies, the music kind of seeped into my DNA over that year and a half. And I had a lot more headspace, a lot more brain space to think about the lyrics and to work on those after the tour was over. I was focused during the tour really on every performance that night and not so much on trying to land pop songs for the next album. So most of the work that I did, most of my contribution came after the tour was done. Thematically, the record is a lot about people, about movement. It's got this velocity to it from song to song. But a lot of that had to do with my abandoning New York in the early 90s and following my best friend to Los Angeles, moving to LA and kind of in a way living and discovering the American West for the first time. And then it's a place where Peter Buck came from. His grandfather, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, was the sheriff of LA County.
Police officer in Lancaster, California.
Well, so maybe I did a little Buckland exaggeration. exaggeration of his story there, but there was a lot, there was a lot of history and a lot of stories that I could tap into, and a kind of new way of looking at not only America, but the world. And I use that to good end, I think.
You know, in looking back and talking about this record, it has occurred to me, this is a record about transition. Both the literal transition of us being on the road and going from city to city, which is, you know, directly referenced in one song at least, but certainly infuses the record, but also transitions that we weren't aware of. It's the transition that Bill, it's the last record with Bill in the band. It's a transition into a new record contract. It's just a record of movement and change. And I think that's one reason it works. And that's one reason that it's okay that the songs are all very different and it really leaps from one type of song to the next. There's not a lot of cohesion on this record except for the feeling of movement. And that's what ties it all together.
Well, I kind of almost, there is cohesion. I completely agree with everything you said, but we have to state this was not about us. This is not a record about a band touring, right?
I mean, no. The transition was just an with the element around what we were doing. It wasn't about that at all. It was just something that infused its way into the record.
Well, that infusion, I think, is profoundly important because you can really feel it in the tracks. What these guys were doing, you know, we were in this hyper adrenalized state, being on tour and performing every night or every other night. And you feel that in the music. It creates this bristling landscape for me to people with the narrative arcs and the characters that I invented. It remains my favorite REM album. It remains my favorite record of any record that we made. Now, it has recently, in the past couple of years, been joined in the number one slot by Reveal. I have to admit, I have a soft spot in my heart for that record. But New Adventures in Hi-Fi is absolutely my favorite record of us, most definitely of us as a four piece.
Yeah, I remember the first time I heard it, and it went with every record that you all had done. I think as a lot of artists will say, you know, as sort of a reaction to the last record. But this one, I think, was the most drastic, like coming off of Monster, which, real quick, personally speaking, was a record that literally changed my life. A day in 1994 when someone slipped some headphones over me and I heard Bang and Blame in a very rural town in the middle of the Kentucky nowhere, my life changed. So Monster became a very important record. And then hearing this one, like, it's even more surprising hearing that so much of it was sort of created around Monster for it to be so drastically different musically speaking. And there are those moments where I feel like they do talk to each other, but where did that come from? I mean, here you are doing this, you know, sort of glamish thing on stage, and then to go back and the music wasn't that.
I like the way you said that, the dialogue between Monster, the record that we did before that, the tour itself, and this album. You definitely hear it in The Wake Up Bomb. There's that ironic distance that we borrowed really from, you know, Peter had moved to Seattle and bought a house with his wife at the time. And Kurt and Courtney literally bought the house next door. They shared a fence. I mean, they could look into each other's windows. And he became friends with all those guys. And so suddenly there was this really exciting thing that was happening in Seattle that Peter was a part of. And we had that, but we also had, you know, you two had released Octoon Baby and Zooropa, and we're applying this ironic distance to themselves to be able to kind of knock themselves down as celebrities and as public figures and as big pop stars. And that had a profound impact on me as a lover of music, also as a friend of those guys. I thought it was fantastic what they were doing, and it was my favorite thing that they'd done. So we took that same kind of ironic distance accidentally, I think. I don't think we did it on purpose, Mike, but using glam rock as kind of a base, that's what Monster became. And that's what the presentation of Monster on the road in 95 became. In the background, we had moved beyond that. We were already on to the next thing and trying not to repeat ourselves. And in doing that, we wound up writing, you know, as I said, my favorite record of us as a four piece.
Being up there writing them like that, though, like, I think I've heard, maybe it was in the liner notes, you all talk about like the spontaneity Was that exactly, because when you're in a studio, I guess what I'm getting to, when you're in a studio, you have all the time in the world to work on a song, to change a song, to decide when a song ends. But doing it in this way, did a lot of that kind of, did it allow for a lot of that spontaneity to leave in there, both musically and with the lyrics?
I have to say, Kyle, when you're in the studio and you're the last guy to turn in your homework, and you have Mike Mills, Peter Buck, and Bill Berry staring you down from the couch behind the control, you don't have all the time in the world at all. There was a lot of pressure. And, you know, we can look back on it and laugh, but it was intense at the time for sure. And these guys were always very loving and very thoughtful about the pressure that they put on me. But it was a high pressure situation. They had done their part. They were finished, except for the arrangements, and then helping me, you know, with background vocals and such to support the vocal. But they were kind of done and twiddling their thumbs at one point. The onus was on me to now take what they had created and try to not bring it down, but bring it up, to lift it higher.
Yeah. You know, spontaneity is great when you can get it, but you can't just produce a song spontaneously. Sometimes you get lucky, like How the West Was Won, certainly one of my favorites on that record, literally was like creation ex nihilo. Bill Berry was playing a little drum part while I was sitting at the piano. I literally started playing that song, and it was written in about the 3.5 minutes it takes to play it. It was done, at least as far as the drums and piano part. So that was super spontaneous. And in keeping with that, I did the solo. Solo, that's a mighty nice word for what that piano piece is. But I tried to pretend like it was some guy we just dragged in off the street who'd never played piano before and said, okay, do something one time. You get one take, that's it. And that's what we did. And so what's on there, I'm not an improvisational piano player. I don't have riffs or licks on the piano. So I just sort of winged it. And I tried to lean on Thelonious Monk's dictum that there are no wrong notes. And, you know, tried to apply that to this. And literally it was one take. And I said, that's it. That's all it gets.
I've heard you talk about that in the documentary too, that comes along with this. And again, I'll mention the deluxe edition of the album Over My Shoulder that comes with all of this. But there's also a point in there where you say that there is a lot of religion on this record, but I hope nobody asks about it because it's not exactly what you think it is. But there is a lot of references. And I started thinking about religion as a writing tool, something that you had used before. And I was wondering if you could talk a little about that, because it seems like it's a very helpful tool to use when you need it.
Well, it's a world that Mike and I both grew up in and grew up through, and it infused itself into our beliefs and the way that we treat each other, the way we treat other people. But I'm not a follower of scripture. That said, there's a lot to tap into when you're dealing with these giant themes or trying to take giant themes and kind of push them into a story that is then relatable and translatable to an audience, right? I'm thinking specifically of Undertow, I guess. And there's a degree in that song of denial on the part of the main character, where in the last line he accepts that he's drowning and he says, "I'm just going to give up and let this be what it is. I'm going to be like the birds that he references throughout the song." But then in the last line he says that his body, like all bodies, have to breathe, and so he'll just start breathing water. And it's a leap of faith that's like, okay, wow, you were an atheist up until that last moment, and then you kind of lost it at the end, and it's quite beautiful. Nick Cave, who else? I mean, there are so many people that tapped into scripture to create incredible careers. Nick Cave is the one person I can think of that really, the exemplary example of that. But it's something that I didn't necessarily want to overtly tap into. But and I also, I love writing from perspectives that are not mine. It pushes me as a creative person to do, I hate that term, it pushes me as a writer to place myself in places that I do not belong and try to see things from a different perspective. That's maybe part of being a Capricorn. You know, I smell like a goat, but I also have some of those kind of climb the mountain slowly tendencies and wanting to see every situation from every possible perspective. It also, I think, Mike makes me maddening to work with sometimes, but anyway, Yeah, enough about me.
It's all about the results.
Did I start that sentence with the word I?
Maybe. There's some interesting parallels I'm drawing to the other anniversary that's happening, which is 10 years ago. And I think it's a few anniversaries, but 10 years ago, you all put out your final record, fantastic, Collapse Into Now. You get the greatest hits. The final song we hear even is Hallelujah as we talk about religion. You know, we get to there. And they even share Patti Smith. You know, I think that's the other big moment here, which, you know, you get her on Blue on Collapse Into Now, and then you get her on what is it? It's Ebo, right? That's the one she's on. And I don't know. I'm just all praising Patti Smith here in case we want to do that a second. But Michael, on the documentary, you talk about you just wanting to reach out to her. And I think that was the first time, but I didn't get to hear about what that actually was like. I mean, you finally get to meet her. Here's one of your heroes. What was that moment for you?
Well, we met over the telephone. I called her from a phone booth in a hash bar in San Sebastian, Spain, jet lagged as I've ever been in my life. And we were there with a bunch of friends that were there to celebrate the beginning of the European tour. Doug Copeland was there. Jane Pratt was there. Nena Cherry and her whole family, my goddaughters, were there. Richard Linklater was there. I mean, it was super weird, but and my two best friends, Tom Gilroy and Jim McKay, both writers, directors, were there. And we ran into these anarchist film students and wound up in a hash bar on Valentine's Day, 1995 in San Sebastian, Spain. Mike and I had arrived from Singapore. We were insanely jet lagged. I had just written Departure, which because I had this experience on the plane on the way there. So I was feeling really good about myself. And Fred Sonic Smith had recently passed away. And we knew Patti, although we'd never spoken or met each other, through Scott Litt, who was our producer, who had worked with Patti and Fred on Dream of Life. And I told him I wanted to reach out to her. She had to feel very alone. And so he asked her if it was okay to give me her number, and she said yes. So I called her, and I just said, you know, I'm sure that this is a difficult day for you, but I just want you to know that, you know, there are people in the world who are thinking about you, and I'm one of them. Later that year, the band went through Detroit, and we played several months later, I guess. We played in Detroit, and Patti and her two children were living in the outskirts of Detroit. I went to visit them on a day off, and that was the first time we met.
Just incredible how that all comes around, and you get to be with your heroes, which is always a nice part of this job, the perks of this job anyway. I want to quickly catch up to I know we're running out of time here, but just the present really quickly. Michael, first off, I love the stuff that you've done with Aaron Dessner with the one track we heard so far with, we played it a lot over here at WFPK, and it's fantastic. And then I go to put the Flag Day soundtrack in the other day, and there's Ed Vedder doing Drive. And you've got Jason Isbell doing a couple of tracks on his new record with Night Swimming and Driver 8. People have been covering you guys for years and years and years, but to have these artists doing it, I mean, first off, were you tipped off beforehand? Do they call you and say, hey, is this okay? Or do you listen to this beforehand?
With Eddie and Sean?
Yeah, with Ed and Isbell too.
Yeah, Jason, I don't know, Mike, did we know that Jason was going to do that? We knew that he had set a goal for himself if Georgia went blue.
To do an album of Georgia songs, yeah. Yeah, and I knew there was going to be, I knew Driver 8 was going to be on there. I didn't know he was doing Night Swimming. That was interesting.
His melodic take on Driver 8, the way he rephrases certain lines, it makes me actually jealous. I listened to it several times and sang along. It was super great. And I wrote him a note. I've never met Jason, but I wrote him a note to tell him how grateful we were that he had done such a beautiful job with those songs. With Sean Penn and Eddie Vedder, we're great friends with Ed. So he reached out to say, look, I don't know if this is insane, but I'm going to do this. And are you okay with it? And what can we have it for the movie if it turns out good? And I said, without even, and we always check in with each other, but I knew where Mike and Peter and Bill live on this type of subject. And I said, you have our blessing. Like, please do whatever you want with it. I'm thrilled with the idea that people now feel comfortable covering REM, because for the longest time, we seemed like the most uncoverable band. And maybe it's the material, and maybe it's, I don't know what the subject matter, but people didn't really go there, and now they are, and that feels super good.
It is weird. There's something odd about the amount of time that it takes for, or it took for us to go from being, you know, however popular we were while we were extant as a recording unit, to the time when people felt comfortable recording us. And I always wondered why it didn't happen more often. I didn't lose any sleep over it, but I did wonder why. And now it's everywhere. I mean, there are people, you know, people as famous as Jason and Ed doing things. There are a lot of people I've never heard of that are doing really fun, unusual covers of REM songs in genres that I wasn't even familiar with. And it's very exciting. It's really cool to see your stuff reimagined by an entire new generation of musicians.
I hum Airport Man, you know, at least once or twice a week. So that's not covering, but I'm covering around the house anyway. So it's
if you're able to hum Airport Man, you're a better man than I am, Kyle. I have to say. talk about openers for albums. I mean, we thought How the West Was Won and Where It Got Us was a weird one. And Mike, we also, when we played that that show in DC for the Tibet House, Tibet Freedom, we opened with Airport Man, right? Yeah. Like a 6-minute version, and I'm in a fucking sarong. I mean, what were we thinking?
Well, we're contrarians, you know. We kind of always have been, and we just really chose to expose that side of our nature for those two records.
Thank goodness, because again, it's some of my favorite work that you guys have done. I'll just quickly ask then, what comes next? Is there more music? I mean, Michael, you've been putting out the stuff. Mike, either one of you got stuff on the way that we can, you know. I'm a greedy bastard. I'm a fan. That's what is happening right now.
Yeah. Well, the Baseball Project is doing a new record in January. I'm writing songs with a couple of different groups of people. I have two things coming out next year. A lot of shows where we combine classical and rock and roll. The concerto I wrote is being played at the Met in New York, which is very exciting. And we're going to be doing we're going to be touring a thing where the first half of is something called REM Explored, which is two great arrangers taking 5 REM songs and completely deconstructing them and turning them into something. I don't even know what it's going to be because I haven't heard it yet. Second half of the concert will be my concerto with full orchestra. Very exciting stuff. And then we have something called A Night of Georgia Music, which is I curated songs either about Georgia or by Georgia artists. And it's all instrumental, but it relies on the virtuosity of Robert McDuffie, the violinist, and Chuck Lavelle, the pianist. And it's a very exciting hour of Georgia music.
Well, I can't wait to hear all the stuff that does come from, you know, whatever the future holds from both of you. In the meantime, we got the beauties like this right here, New Adventures in Hi-Fi, again, the deluxe edition. It's so much fun digging in deeper with all of this and the B-sides and all that. Guys, thank you so much for 40 years worth of music and thank you for taking the time to talk about it today. This really meant a lot to me.
Thank you. Stay tuned. There's more coming for sure.
Awesome. All right. Take care, fellas.
All the best. Bye.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead. Download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
Michael Stipe and Mike Mills talking again about the 25th anniversary of New Adventures in Hi-Fi. A few years ago, Mike Mills and I caught up about what was then the 20th anniversary of Up, the album that came after New Adventures, as well as the 10th anniversary of Accelerates. I'm going to include a couple more interviews, and we'll start right here. Part 2 of Kyle Meredith with REM.
First off, though, I should say, so we're in Louisville. I noticed that you were just at the Derby again, right?
I was. I come as often as I can to help benefit the Unbridled Foundation and have a good time while doing so.
Yeah? Do you walk away with anything, money-wise?
No, I did okay at the Oaks hopefully came close to breaking even by the end of it all.
That's about the best we can all hope for. So to break.
That's all I can ask. Yeah.
So there's 3 years I kind of want to hit on, and they all end with eight. 2018, 1998, and 2008. I thought we'd spin the wheel, and I'd let you decide where we go first.
Given my memory, 2018 is probably the best start.
We'll start with the present then. Lately, I noticed you've been doing sort of messing around in the classical world, a concerto for violin, rock band, and string orchestra. I'd love to know what that's about.
Well, my very good friend Robert McDuffie came to me a few years ago and said that he could play Beethoven and Tchaikovsky until his hair fell out, and he'd rather try something different. And he asked if I would write a half-hour concerto for as you said, violin, rock band, and string orchestra. Bobby and I have been friends since grammar school, actually, early high school. And so I gave it a shot. It's really not, strictly speaking, a classical piece. It's more of a song suite. But it does have the elements that define a concerto, which is that it's about a half-hour piece of music that relies heavily on the virtuosity of the soloist, in this case, Bobby McDuffie. And, you know, it's something we really enjoy doing. We work a lot with youth orchestras when we play it around the country, as well as other symphonies. And, you know, we're just trying to show people that the gap between classical and rock and roll might not be as quite as wide as people think it is.
And I think I've used that term, heard that term a lot, too. You know, the line from Beethoven to the Beatles. As you say, it's pretty small.
Well, yeah, I think people are surprised when they see this, because they might be expecting one thing and they get a really great combination of, I think, you know, some of the best parts of classical and rock and roll.
Now, I know you're you know, enough years away separated from REM to have that in the rear view, but this still has to seem like such a different world and a different setup for you, or does it?
Well, you know, it is, in fact, because most of the venues so far in which we've performed are classical music venues. We have done shows, you know, we work with these string orchestras. We've played with the Toronto Symphony, which is very intimidating. So it's not brand new ground, but it hasn't really been done that often that we try to combine the Venn diagram between the two types of music. So, you know, it's a little bit of uncharted territory, but we're making it work.
Now, outside of this, I mean, what do you keep yourself busy with lately, music-wise? I mean, are you still working in the rock world? I know a handful of years ago, you and I have a mutual friend with Joseph Arthur, so, you know, you'd been on tour with Joe. And but are you doing anything else in the rock world right now?
You know, I do some charity stuff. I of course, enjoy playing golf, so I try to combine charity music events with golf events. Patrick Warburton has a huge event every year out in the desert that raises a ton of money for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. I'll actually be doing another event for St. Jude in early June in Memphis that Steve Cropper is hosting. So, you know, those things are really fun for me to do good work and have a good time doing it. We're hoping the Baseball Project can do a run of shows late this summer if Scott McCoy is feeling up to it. So, you know, there are fingers in different pies here.
Gotcha. I know Scott right now is with Joe and Peter Buck. Joe, see, to me, Joe is just slowly putting REM back together in the most long way around possible. So,
well, you know, I've been a fan of Joe's for a long time, as you know, and I haven't heard he and Peter's work yet, which is slack of me, but I will be listening soon, and I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, it's a really great record. With the REM world, because there seems to be relevant news, Scott Aukerman and Adam Scott's REM podcast, have you been keeping up with that?
I'm aware of it. Adam and I communicate occasionally. I have not had the time to sit and listen to it yet, but I'm very much looking forward to it. He's a funny guy.
This seems like also, you know, an interesting way for a new audience still to find REM after all these years. You know, maybe not coming in the entrance from one of the big hits like a lot of us made it. I don't know if you've seen any impact from that, or even if that crosses your mind, like where the new generation, how the new generation finds your old work.
Well, you know, it certainly brings some new fans to the fold, I think, or reinforces for a lot of other fans that they're not the only ones that like it. It's really nice of someone of Adam's stature to make a point of talking about it. You know, music is always out there. I came to a lot of music later on myself. You know, there are a lot of ways that you find out about music, and not all of it is from the radio, fortunately, or satellite radio, or whatever the coin of the realm is currently. But it's really good that that people encounter music in unexpected ways.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, as far as that band goes, and you know, I follow you pretty closely on Twitter. I like keeping up and liking the things that you're saying, because with the current White House, I keep thinking, though, isn't it a shame there's no new REM record? And I know that's not even in the pie right now, but oh, the things I feel like you all would be saying right now.
Well, it's true. Social media certainly is a double-edged sword, but at least it gives people a chance to speak their mind, state their opinions, and you can engage with like-minded people, or you can have hopefully intelligent discussions with people who disagree. Yeah. And Twitter itself is a very instantaneous method of doing that. You know, I enjoy the give and take. It's also nice to be able to vent. I just think everyone should have a political opinion, and I think everyone should be involved in politics. And I think the more Americans that do participate, the better the result we're going to get is.
As far as, though, you know, on the writing, do you find yourself writing about any of this? Do you work on solo music in that way?
I tend to concentrate more on the instrumental and melodic side of music. I enjoy lyrics and I enjoy words, but I often find myself hitting a wall when I try to write them myself. But yeah, I mean, that's why a lot of times I say this to things I have to say in social media rather than writing songs about it, because I don't always feel that I express myself as well with lyrics. But certainly, you know, there's plenty of material to draw upon these days.
Well, we'll spin the wheel a little bit. I want to head back 10 years because Accelerate just celebrated its 10th anniversary. I always feel like this is a record that sort of gets lost in the bigger REM conversation right now. And see if we can jog your memory a little bit, because at the time, for various reasons, this was sort of called the comeback album, the rock album. In retrospect, is that a fair assessment?
You know, given the inevitability of people needing to put labels on things, I think that's as fair as any. You know, obviously, none of us were thrilled with Around the Sun. It started out really well, and we made the mistake of trying to do a tour in the middle of making a record. You know, we learned a lesson from that, which is that once you start a record, you need to forge on through to the end. You know, by the time we got back from the tour and tried to finish Around the Sun, we'd sort of lost focus and weren't exactly sure where we were going with it. So it ended up being a bit meandering as far as we were concerned. So when we did Accelerate, we decided to make the songs as short and punchy and powerful as possible. We edited ourselves very, very heavily, more so than we've ever done before. And, you know, we just wanted to make it pithy and so we had to say get in and get out. You know, Peter and I have always agreed that there's very little more powerful than a 3-minute pop song or rock song. So that's kind of what we shot for with that.
And it does have one complete sound. I mean, at the time, I don't think you guys had done that since maybe Monster. Monster seemed to have that one combining sound that went all the way through it. But this one, for a band that is so creative and you did so many different sounds throughout the years, it seems like to me it'd almost be a challenge to have one cohesive sound run all the way through a record like that.
Well, that's actually very well said. You know, for anybody that's been doing their craft for years, you have to branch out and experiment and try different things. And we certainly did that, you know, to varying degrees of success. And when we got together with this, and we said, this has to be focused. This has to be tightly focused and laser sharp. And that in itself is a challenge, especially when you haven't done that for a few years.
You know, looking back, when Collapse In and Out and the breakup was announced and everything, you had talked about how you had known it was coming for a few years. Did you know that the end of REM was coming during Accelerate? Because when I look at a song like Until the Day Is Done, it seems like it's spelled out perfectly for everybody.
No, we weren't really aware of it at that point. We became more aware of it as the tour went on, the 2008 tour. If you want clues in songs, they're on Collapse Into Now. Mm-hmm. There are two or three songs on that record that address the coming disbanding. But really, when we were making that record, we were just trying to reestablish ourselves to ourselves, not so much to anyone else, but to ourselves as a tight rock unit, and you know, just prove to ourselves that we still had the force to pull it together to make a great record.
I want to cheat a bit here, because you did bring up Collapse Into Now. Well, I did actually, but did you ever wish that album had been able to be toured? Because it's, you know, it never got the live chance in the way the others did.
Well, you know, I suppose that it would have been a cool thing, but I don't really have any regrets about it, because we were pretty sure that the 2008 tour would be the last one, and we never had any plans to tour Collapse Into Now. It was a record that was made to sort of say goodbye with. You know, we didn't want to do the tour where everyone knew it was the last tour. You know, we didn't want to do one of those big farewell things of all sentimental and maudlin and like, oh, we're going to miss you guys and all that stuff. We just wanted to, you know, make our statement, put the record out, and then say goodbye.
Well, I do want to jump back in 10 more years further just for a moment here to talk about Up, which is getting its 20th anniversary this year. First off, this is one of my favorite REM albums. Up, I absolutely love. I might have listened to it more than any other record in your catalog.
Wow. Well,
but from what I understand, it was sort of a difficult record to make. Is that right?
Well, it didn't start out that way. I mean, you know, we started working on the songs with Bill in the band, and then we found out that Bill didn't want to be in the band anymore. So that left us with an option. We could either stop or we could keep going. And Bill insisted that we keep going. He said, look, I'm not going to be the guy that broke up REM. So we decided to go ahead and make a record. And we figured since we didn't have a drummer, we would go machine and use machines for the most part. Obviously, Barrett Martin did a great job on Lotus. But we wanted to just say, look, okay, everything's changed. All the rules are out the window. Let's try something completely different here. I'm really happy with Up. It was a lot of fun to make what for REM was an electronica record. You know, certainly Kraftwerk might disagree with that, but for us it was a lot of fun to be machine oriented. Musically it was a lot of fun. The dynamics of the band had obviously changed. You know, without Bill as a balancing force in the band, all of our quirks and foibles became a little more obvious to each other. And you know, we just had to reestablish the balance of being in a band together. And that was something that, you know, you might not want to do that while you're making a record, but nonetheless, that's the hand we were dealt. So we got through it very well, and I'm pretty proud of that.
There are songs on there that sound nothing like you all had ever done before. I mean, starting it off with Airport Man is a statement in itself.
It really was. Well, that was my idea, which is at this point, it was like, you know what? There was criticism coming in from some directions about things. And I said, okay, well, here it is. You know, we are not going to pander to anybody with this record. This is what we sound like. And this is probably the least pop song we've ever done. So we're going to make it first. And if you can deal with this, then you can deal with anything. I kind of enjoyed the contrarianism of that maneuver, but some people didn't like it as much.
Nigel Godrich helped you out with this. Did he have anything to do with those sounds? Because he's sort of known for that type of thing.
Oddly enough, the sounds came more from Pat McCarthy. Pat is still an extremely talented man who has a lot of unusual ideas. And, you know, a lot of the noises were keyboards and machines that Peter had found in looking through antique stores and garage sales. And we just gave Pat a free hand to say, here, make some noises and see what kind of sound beds you can make for us. So I think it was probably more Pat than Nigel, although Nigel was a big piece of the record. I think it was more Pat McCarthy.
Yeah. Well, I can't say enough great things about that record again. I mean, At My Most Beautiful and Day Sleeper, I mean, those are two perfect songs in my world. So, you know, I appreciate all you guys did with that. Really do.
Thank you.
Well, that's our trip through time right there. I don't think we need to go back another 10 years to 88 at this point. That's been well tread many times over. So
you are correct.
It is a pleasure, Mike, talking with you and catching up. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I'll look forward to if you guys do the baseball project again. When that happens.
Well, I look forward to that, too. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Now we'll jump all the way back to 2011. This is when REM decided to call it quits. They released their final album and then a greatest hits. And that's where Mike Mills and I got to catch up in part 3 of Kyle Meredith with REM.
Putting together the compilation, it looks like you beat Warner Brothers to the punch by preparing all of this before you even announced your split. Is that accurate? Did you guys know that this was going to happen? Like, all right, we're going to split up and the label's going to want the greatest hits and here we go.
Well, the greatest hits was something, or the compilation, the retrospective, actually, which is a more accurate term for what it is. No, we knew that was coming. That's been on the burner for some time. As far as breaking up, we started talking about that on the 2008 tour, and it really began to crystallize you know, between the end of that and then the making of Collapse into Now. So I think it was a really nice sort of coincidence, synergistic thing that the breakup of the band coincided with a retrospective that was already going to happen anyway.
When you were putting this together, did you consider any alternate takes or song or production bonuses? Are there any in there for us to find? That because that happened back on the 80s compilation too, didn't it?
Yeah, we threw some curveballs in there, but this one is really, you know, there are a couple of ways to look at it. I always think of, you know, the Martian who lands on Earth after the nuclear war, and there's nothing left except this two CD set of REM songs. And you know, we're going for that Martian market, and so he listens to it and goes, oh, okay, this was a pretty good band. Or, more realistically, for some 12-year-old kid who's just getting into music, and he's heard of this band REM, but he wants to know what they're all about. And if you listen to this, it pretty much covers all the bases for us. So it was actually, you know, not a really hard compilation to put together, and I think it represents us really well, especially the three new songs, because that's pretty much what REM sounds like in 2011.
As you were looking back, can you name any one single song that you think defines REM? I mean, here you're saying here's two discs that defines REM. Is there that quintessential REM track?
You know, that is a question that normally I would say no. We do too many kinds of music. Our songs are more diverse than you can really pin down. But I've sort of changed my mind on that, and I will throw out Man on the Moon as a song that pretty much captures what REM is about. You know, it's incredible lyrics. It's musically brilliant, I think. It's got a lot of great harmony singing on it. It's a fun song, and yet it's emotionally powerful. I would put that up as a pretty good indicator.
I suddenly imagine that alien coming to Earth being a radio programmer who says, I've got 30 seconds, tell me one song.
You know, I don't know how they do things on Mars, but it might be like that.
I wanted to ask you about one specific record, and I think it's been one of the more interesting records of your career, and that was number 13 with Around the Sun. That's one that I think was probably not just kind of critically panned, but it seemed like that was the one time where the band said, oops. But you turned around, and then with when the live record that came out right after it, almost all of those songs was redeemed, and I was just kind of wondering if you had made up with that album.
Well, I don't mind that album. Here's the thing about it. It's there are great songs on that record, as you can tell by the live record that came after that. The songs themselves are great. I mean, there's some of them that I'd put up against anything else. But we just made a mistake in logistics. We thought it'd be okay to start that record and then take a break in the middle and record a couple of new songs for another, you know, the first greatest hits compilation, and then go on tour for that for months, and then try to come back and finish the record. And the fact is, that's not the way you make records. You start the record, you work on it, and you finish it. And that's just a lesson that we learned. So what happened was, you know, we when we left, we were very excited about that record, and then we got back from the tour and tried to go back in the studio and finish it, and we just really didn't have a focus. We didn't know where it was supposed to go or how to get it there. And we tried all these different things and ended up maybe trying too many things. And so at the end, we had a record that was just unfocused and unrealized, which was kind of sad because those songs deserved better. And in fact, they got it on the live record.
Yeah, and they really have sounded great every time I've heard them, too. So thank you for the clearance on that. A band gets to a point in their life, as REM has, when they start influencing other bands. And you guys have been doing that now for a very long time. When you hear of a new band coming out saying, yeah, they sound like REM. But it seems always around that time that, you know, and maybe I'm wrong, you're the one who actually gets interviewed here, but that interviewers stop asking the whole question of, you know, what are your current influences yourself? Because here you are influencing every other band. And I was curious about that, you know, if there is something right now that's redefining your tastes, and maybe it's not even music, maybe it's a movie or book or a piece of art, but as you further yourself along here, what are you listening to or seeing that's really keeping you creative?
Wow. Oh, man, of course, that's when I get brain freeze, when I really want to tell about all the things I'm listening to. You know, I'm excited about that new Lars von Trier movie, Melancholia. That looks exciting to me. I heard a song by a band called Real Estate that I have just downloaded their LP, and I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm excited about that because I like the song It's Real.
Oh, yeah. And a good video about dogs.
Oh, is it?
All about dogs.
I look forward to that. You know, the Low Anthem are doing some really fun stuff. You know, Wilco is certainly carrying the flag for one of the best American bands out there. The Jayhawks are back together. That makes me very excited. You know, there are plenty of fun things out there and exciting, both old and new.
Yeah. You all, of course, this all ends amicably, but are you going to miss REM? Do you expect that you're going to miss REM, or are you just ready? Is this it? You're ready to move on?
What I'll miss is performing on stage, because, you know, the thing that makes a band is the chemistry that occurs when a certain group of people make music together. I mean, you could find five people that are tremendous players, but if they don't have that chemistry, it just doesn't matter. But the fact is, with Peter and Michael and I, and with Peter and Bill and Michael and I, there was something that happened, and you could feel it, and it was very real, and certainly that aspect of it I'll miss. Everything else, we're all perfectly at peace about it. You know, we walked away on our own terms at the timing and the placing all of it was all our idea. And so, no regrets about that at all. But of course, I'll miss singing and playing with those guys.
Are you working on a solo record?
I'm not currently working on a solo record, but, who knows what's going to happen. There's all kind of musical things floating around for next year. And I imagine at some point in my career, I'll sit down and put some stuff together and put out the Mike Mills Experience featuring Mike Mills.
Do you think it's going to be, it's obviously, I guess, going to be different for you to transition into a front man when that time gets here?
Well, that's certainly one of the things you have to think about. I'm not a front man. I don't have, I don't have that kind of charisma. I don't have that kind of desire or whatever it is it takes to be a front man. I don't think I have it. So that's why I was always perfectly happy, with being in a band and not being the front man. And just because you put out a record doesn't mean you have to tour. You can make a record without ever leaving your house. But that just remains to be seen. Who knows? I may get this burst of ego and creativity and say, go out and be a front man. Maybe I'll do that. But that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Well, I certainly do look forward to every single thing we're going to hear from you. I mean, obviously, this is not the end of Mike Mills right here, but the
certainly
beginning,
not.
Right? It's the beginning.
It is. It is the beginning of a whole new phase. I mean, everybody's very excited about it. Michael's going to, I think he likes his visual arts, and he'll work with sculpture and photography and things in the art world. And Peter will continue to play music. He's out with John Wesley Harding, I think, as we speak. And, I've been speaking to a lot of musicians I love and respect about doing some work together. So I think 2012 is going to be a really fun year.
All right. Well, thank you for so much for taking the moment here and taking the time here.
You're welcome. Thank you, Kyle.
And again, my thanks to Mike Mills and Michael Stipe. Once again, the new box set is New Adventures in Hi-Fi 25th Anniversary Edition. It's out now. Thanks to you as well for checking out the episode, the series. Please do hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that I put out every single week. 3 brand new interviews to keep you up to date with your favorite artists. At all the usual spots that you can subscribe to podcasts. That does include YouTube as well for the video versions. After all of that, head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, an hour full of song premieres, music news, anniversary spins, bonus interviews. Again, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots, including Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all 3 of them at Kyle Meredith, over on TikTok at Kyle M. Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey guys, sorry I'm a little bit late. Let's make sure that we give ourselves enough time because there's not much time anyway.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.